Ephesians 5 and 6 is often referred to as a household code, and we have referred to that many times throughout this theme on Ephesians. And it details the relations between husbands and wives in chapter 5, and in chapter 6 between children and parents, slaves and masters. In these comparisons, how does Paul point to an egalitarian ideal rather than to an authoritarian one? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm your host, Alden Thompson, Professor Emeritus in Biblical Studies from Walla Walla University. My conversation partners are John McVeigh, President of Walla Walla University, and Brant Berglund, current member of the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Both he and John McVeigh are New Testament scholars indeed. John McVeigh has steeped himself in the study of Ephesians, focusing on the Pauline epistle for his doctoral study at the University of Sheffield in England. He is also the author of the official study guide, known in Adventist circles as the Quarterly. But in a sense, in The Good Word this quarter, we are plowing new ground, because heretofore the host has always been the author of the study guide. But in this case, Dr. McVeigh, whom I shall sometimes simply refer to as John, has not only written the Quarterly and the Pacific Press companion book, but also has put together a rather monumental study guide, which is available online for your personal use. So let's now turn to the leading question. I would like for us, I think we have enough time to do this, explore this household code business, relationships between husbands, wives, parents, children, masters, slaves. And let me read the leading question as I put it. Ephesians 5 and 6 is often referred to as a household code, detailing the relation between husbands and wives in chapter 5, and in chapter 6 between children and parents, slaves and masters. In these comparisons, how does Paul point to an egalitarian ideal rather than to an authoritarian one? And maybe we ought to take each one by itself first, and then we can bring them together.
So what's the first one?
Husbands and wives.
Okay. This is a fascinating piece of literature, because this topic, household management, became almost a common one in literature of the time. Now, I'm saying the time broadly, the centuries before and the literature that was available in the time of Paul. But it was written very differently by other authors than Paul. So you can go to Sirach, for example, a Jewish document in the 2nd century B.C., and you can read the kind of counsel that you tend to find in these documents. Do you have a wife who pleases you? Do not divorce her, but do not trust yourself to one whom you detest. About a son, pamper a child and he will terrorize you. Play with him and he will grieve you. Discipline your son and make his yoke heavy so that you may not be offended by his shamelessness. With regard to a slave, fodder and a stick and burdens for a donkey, bread and discipline and hard work for a slave. Yoke and thong will bow the neck of an ox, and for a wicked slave there are racks and tortures. Now, this is cheerful, happy literature, right?
Delightful.
But notice that it is like virtually all the other examples that we could cite. It is written to the person in power, right? It's written to the father. It's written to the husband. It's written to the slave owner. And the subjugated partner, if I can use that term, is not addressed at all.
That's right.
Isn't that fascinating? In this household code, which is the best example we probably have in the New Testament, along with a shorter passage from Colossians, it addresses these same three relationships that go way back to Aristotle as being foundational in human society. But notice that Paul addresses the subjugated partner in each case, and he addresses that individual first. So he addresses Christian wives before he addresses Christian husbands. He addresses Christian children before he addresses Christian parents, and he addresses Christian slaves before he addresses Christian slave owners or slave masters. And in each case, he spends most of his time and attention limiting the power of the father, the husband, the father, and the slave master.
It seems a bit like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. You address those who are oppressed and say, if somebody strikes you on one cheek, turn to them the other, that you as a subjugated person supposedly have the ability to change the outcome through kindness and good behavior anyways.
Yeah, and there's something quite profound going on here, because I would argue, I think, that at least in the case of the wife and the slave, Paul is calling for a grand substitution.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, put the exalted Jesus in the place of your husband, in the place of your slave master, and serve the risen Christ.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the slave, he suggests this grand substitution over and over again, and of course we'll come to that in due course. But how this all applies in the context of Paul's counsel to husbands and wives is fascinating for me. You used in the lead question, you used the term egalitarian, but I'm going to suggest to you that Paul offers a different model than an egalitarian one here, or what's the other model we tend to cite these days? A complementarian and egalitarian are the two terms we use. I'm going to argue that Paul offers a different model, and we see that by the fact that there is an Old Testament citation that's at the very apex of his argument. He's going someplace with his argument, and where he's going is to his citation of Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, down in verse 31. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So the complementarian model and the egalitarian model tend to talk about husbands and wives in relationship to each other. Which roles do they have? How do those relate to each other? Are they equal? Are they complementary? And all that sort of thing. Paul's one body, one flesh model encourages us to think about who they are together and what they can accomplish together. You understand what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, I think it's worth bringing Paul's one flesh model alongside these other two that we talk about so frequently.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's intriguing. Now, there's one other question here, which is tangential and may have nothing to do with it, but in our English translations, chapter 21 is separated from chapter 22.
Verse 21 is separated from verse 22.
Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ.
Yes, and you'll notice that the way I have divided the passage, mm-hmm. I've included verse 21, and there's a very good reason for that, and that's the verb submit only occurs in verse 21. It doesn't occur in verse 22. So it's submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ, kind of comma, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. Okay, so the idea of submission is borrowed in the case of the wife from the mutual submission called for in verse 21. Now, it's a hinge verse, and so you will see that most translations, for one reason or another, tend to put verse 21 with what goes before, and the Greek texts tend to put it with what goes afterwards, and that's a good indication that it's actually participating in both passages.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that verb submit, I've included verse 21 with what follows.
Would you say it's fair to suggest that Paul is addressing this, wives being subject to their own husbands, because there was something culturally in Ephesus that would have encouraged women to never take that role, that in the church, the unity of the body required mutual submission, and in Ephesus, perhaps, a city where Artemis, the goddess of fertility, the goddess of the hunt, as a patron goddess, could have encouraged a level of singularness that women would want, an independence from their men that would lead away from unity. Is that possible?
I've certainly read defenses of that. I'm always just a little leery of that kind of a defense, because it depends upon so much on our understanding of the first century and the first century in Ephesus and so on. And I'm sure we have just a tiny percentage of the actual evidence of what life was like back then. So
yeah.
I'm always just a little bit nervous about resting on that. And the fact is, Paul spends most of his time addressing husbands here.
Husbands, right.
And so it seems to me that that's the burden of his argument, is on the husbands, and in a way, what he says to wives is kind of concessionary. Mm-hmm. But there may be something more going on there too. And let me suggest a wild idea. What doesn't always come through in the English translations is how much emphasis Paul's putting on your own husband, your own wife.
Right.
It kind of gets under-translated because it occurs so often in the passage. And that suggests to me that Paul is not just interested in the approved legal marriage between the head of household and the wife. He's also interested in slave marriages. And he's essentially saying, these marriages are valid. This man has a wife. This wife has her own husband. And he may be bounding the authority of the slave master by simply saying, mm-hmm. you can't do what society lets you do in a Christian context. Mm-hmm. You cannot have sexual access to your female slaves. She belongs to another.
Hmm. That's fascinating.
And she is to be subject only in that relationship.
To her own husband.
Right.
And that would explain some strange factors in this. That would explain the husband perhaps being viewed here as analogous to Jesus, as the savior of the body.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, his role is to defend her.
Yep.
And it would also explain all this emphasis on own husband, own wife, and so on.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to hear what you have to say about parents and children.
Well, actually, that's in the next lesson. So we get to talk about that next week.
Oh, well, that's exciting.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll have to plan on that. Today we have explored how the book of Ephesians admonishes husbands and wives to come together at the cross. And I think John has pointed out some fascinating insights there that will be very helpful to us. I want to thank our participants, John McVeigh and Brent Berglund, my conversation partners, and Kristen Byerly, our program engineer. Grateful TY to each of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.